you know, Himanshu, as I mentioned earlier, I don't see COVID affecting anything. I mean, this was just a pause in between.
Hi, I'm Satya Tripathi, United Nations Assistant Secretary General, and you're listening to the EDS Show.
Welcome back. My guest for the day is someone who is an expert when it comes to business, nurturing innovative companies and creating high-performance organizations. He is a stalwart in Indian electronics space, a man who has been the active force with 3+ decades of experience in spearheading divisions and companies in this very space, and presently serving as the Joint Managing Director of Panasonic Life Solutions India. He is Dinesh Agrawal. Hi, Dinesh. Welcome on the show.
Thank you so much, Himanshu. Thank you for having me on the show.
Dinesh, how's COVID-19 situation treating you?
Both personally and business-wise, great. So luckily, my family, so we are a very small family. Me and my wife live in Mumbai, and our son lives in Gurgaon. He works there. So we had not traveled much up to October. And luckily, the place where we stay in Mumbai, the entire building and the complex did not have too many cases. Of course, a lot of it was due to the excellent processes which were set by the society, the Residents Welfare Association, etc. Mm-hmm. So obviously, we could get all the groceries, fruits and vegetables at our doorstep. So not too many cases. Since October, we started traveling a little bit. So we went to my parents' place in Bangalore. We went to Gurgaon to meet our son. We kind of ventured out. Of course, we were always fearful at the back of our mind, but we took whatever precaution we could. It was all fine and safe.
That's great.
And in business terms, I think this whole period has been actually very amazing. It has surprised us. So we obviously had to close down our operations in March. And sometime around mid-May, we started slowly opening up based on the local guidelines release. So we have our factories in Haridwar and in Daman. And we have one factory in Bhuj in Kutch area in Gujarat. So obviously the guidelines were varying at each place in terms of how many workers we would get in. So we started doing that. We had a huge apprehension because we have roughly about 7,800 workers across our various factories. And they come from villages which are in the vicinity of about 50 to 100 kilometers from the factories. And there was this apprehension that will this infection, will it spread on the shop floor? Will it lead to a larger issue on hand? But I think what surprised is the people on the ground, the HR team, the production teams, the administration, local, in all these factories were so proactive, So while we gave them the general guidelines, we formed a task force as all companies must have. And while we just gave a guideline, they actually implemented on ground very efficiently, including going up to the villages of the workers and educating their families on hygiene and the sanitization.
Well, that's great. And one thing which I have noticed that this entire pandemic situation has actually given room for organizations to innovate their business processes and to innovate the way they are functioning so far.
No, absolutely. So, we have been debating about this flexi timing for so many years, mm-hmm. and we never got to do it. So being a traditional manufacturing company, we thought that's not going to work because you need to have meetings and you need to have discussions at a short notice. So if you have flexible timing, people will not be available, etc. All that myth has been, destroyed. We've been having all our review meetings. We've been having discussions at a short notice. All of it, through the MS Teams, earlier Zoom meetings and or teleconferencing. So It's obviously disrupted a lot of things, and it also has shown how much of our processes have actually become automated, you know, where you don't need a single paper to be physically moved from one place to another. I mean, in this entire pandemic, I think I must have just signed physically just about 3 times.
Oh, well.
You know, where it was mandatory to have. So all the other legal documentation, including external agencies, it's all happened online.
Great. And so, you know, one thing which I have also noticed that since everybody was talking about new normal, and earlier organizations were saying that soon they will go back to the old normal. But despite that the vaccination is here in the country, majority of the international corporates are still saying that we are okay with the new normal because it is also helping us save a lot of costs.
Absolutely. So today, if I was asked this question, obviously, we haven't cut down our office space, neither do we plan to. So let's say things become normal from 1st April. Everyone is vaccinated and things are absolutely back to normal. I think we would like to continue this flexibility, you know, which we have given to our employees. So it's very obvious that in the operations where physical presence is necessary, especially production, warehousing operations, to some extent, frontline sales, you know, that will have to be there 100%. But all other functions, I think we will give a flexibility to the employees to work from home when they want to, flexibility in terms of the timings, on a condition that they have to be available if there's a particular meeting, you know, which is lined up. So, yes, to that extent, I think we will continue. So what I envisage is that currently just about 30% of our people are in the office. Maybe this will go up to 60-70%, but the rest, you know, 25-30% people will continue to enjoy flexibility on a rotation basis.
You know, one more thing which I have realized is that this particular pandemic actually gave a lot of opportunity, not just for the existing organizations, but also to startup entrepreneurs to innovate on things which were not, feasible before pandemic. And the way the companies are mushrooming these days, it is actually creating more room and more space for startups to, mark their presence in the entire ball game.
Yeah, so I think one of the most remarkable one, which I'm seeing, in our society also where we live, and I think it's true across the whole of Mumbai and perhaps in NCR area as well, is the emergence of these organized fruits and vegetable suppliers. Now, it's in the first few weeks, this whole supply of fruits and vegetables was, volunteered by some people who, from the colony, who went and tied up with the farmers so that the farmers can bring in a truckload of vegetables every Saturday or Sunday morning and, sell it to people. And very soon, in a period of about 2-3 months, we got an app available on which all the vegetables and the prices were listed. And I could select the fruits and vegetables I want. And on Saturday morning, packed, neatly packed boxes with my name on it would be delivered downstairs. So my payment has gone online. My delivery is there. I can just go and pick it up anytime in the day. Now, this is amazing. And, this could be also some factor of that, farm bill, which is, getting currently debated and fought out so much. But the prices at which this produce has come is unimaginable in a city like Mumbai. Fresh vegetables, cheaper vegetables, neatly packed, ordered through app, paid through app. Also, this is one of the amazing innovation that has happened. Yeah.
I'm sure there are many other innovations which have taken place amidst COVID-19. This has also affected a lot of organizations, especially SMEs, because they couldn't get any support from the government other than more debt, provided they have the eligibility criteria to apply for the debts.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, see, SMEs... let me classify the SMEs into two groups. So, one is a set of SMEs who are depending on an OEM. So it could be an auto OEM, it could be an electrical OEM like us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they bounced back because it was the need of their principal companies to get their suppliers back on track. So we, for example, we got our vendors going, of course, again, based on how the local conditions were. In some cases, we advanced them money. We gave them an advance because we realized that they have a working capital challenge. So we advanced them money, and we got our entire ecosystem going pretty soon. Of course, they had challenges on workers, migrant workers who had gone away. So, it took about 3 to 4 months to get back to 100% normalcy, but it came back. But SMEs which are selling, a commodity or, they're selling a product of their own and more of a commodity, let's say categories which are low involvement categories, they are in a bad shape. Focus on our business. So in the electrical, the small switch manufacturers, the small wire manufacturers, the small lighting manufacturers, they are all in a huge deep trouble, and many of them are actually closed down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a company, I can rejoice because I get more market share. But the sad part is that a lot of regional manufacturers have closed, and they still continue to be affected. They're not able to supply material in the market, and that has helped us, and that is one of the reasons we have grown phenomenally in the last 3 to 4 months.
But do you think that since the bigger organizations are growing and they are capturing the major market share, there is a room for the SMEs, the small manufacturers or retailers, to bounce back and to create their own market once again? Or the dynamics will change?
Some of them will bounce back, and they are bouncing back, because the reason being their distribution is more deeper than the larger companies mm-hmm. like us. So, for example, let's say there's a switch manufacturer in Rajasthan. Now, that manufacturer would be so deeply entrenched in Rajasthan in Tier 4, Tier 5, rural areas, where we are not there at present. So while we are, all the big companies are trying to increase the depth of the distribution, but it will take a while for us to reach those small towns, small villages in Rajasthan where this company is there. So now, depending on a case-to-case basis, if a company has managed to survive this period or managed to get more working capital borrowings and managed to get back their labor, so some of these companies will survive, because in every region also, there is it's not like one company. There are a couple of, or more of regional players. So the regional manufacturers who are bad on working on cash, they have already shut down or will shut down.
There is another saying when we talk about innovation, and I was actually reading this particular article, and I came across a quote shared by Bill Coyne. Bill Coyne is formerly with 3M, and he categorically said that who says don't try to control or make save the fumbling, panicky, glorious adventures or discovery. Long-term growth actually depends on the innovation, and innovation isn't neat. But when we talk about innovation in the established organization, we always try to enforce rules and regulations around innovation, and we actually try to make it a neat innovation, and innovation doesn't work that way. And this could be one of the reasons why majority of the bigger players actually stumbled upon the entire innovation process amidst COVID-19, and they were the one who actually got the huge setback, isn't it?
Absolutely. So, innovation, is the word is normally associated with the technology, or a product. But innovation happens in every function and every level of an organization.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. So, there are two common beliefs I have, which can drive innovation, or for that matter, higher performance of an organization, is that one is the sense of purpose should be very clear, right? Mm-hmm. So most of the times, the managements articulate a sense of purpose, but they don't, work hard enough to make sure that the last employee in the company also understands that. And we've read this in so many books and cases, etc. But in reality, having worked with many organizations, I see that the sense of person, purpose is not fully understood or translated. And that's very, very important. You know, we have to remember that the biggest changes in this world, you know, whether they are religious changes or societal changes, have all happened because of the belief. So some person, a leader, maybe a dictator, has articulated a sense of purpose and the people have followed. So sense of purpose is very important. And second is constant evangelization. So evangelization means you keep talking about that sense of purpose and what has to be done to achieve it at every level of management, day in and day out. You can't just make one announcement from the HR saying that the company is now going to grow 30% next year by doing this and that and that. And then after that, it's gone and forgotten. That feeling has to be imbibed by each level of management and then passed on and spoken about it to the people below. So this is what can drive innovation also. So first of all, I think there are two kind of companies that I think I have seen, and I believe there are a top-down company and there are a bottom-up company. Very clearly, there are companies, largely, I would say, family-owned, family-managed companies, which are top-down companies, and which means that everyone looks to the top to get directions. And while they may be allowed to do a small operational thing on their own, but any directional change, any new initiative has to be approved by the top, right? So now this is where the innovation gets suppressed. It gets killed, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that there are a couple of things that a company must do. First, give people an objective, right? Don't spoon feed them. Don't tell them how to exactly achieve that objective by doing this on day one, day two, day three, day four. Mm-hmm. Give them an objective and let ideas flow freely. Of course, you define the boundaries. Never interrupt a discussion. So suppose you're having a meeting to discuss that idea and how it's got to be executed. Don't interrupt them unless they're going completely astray, right?
Mm.
Because as soon as you as a management start interrupting, you're curbing their ingenuity. They start becoming very cautious.
Mm-hmm.
So second is, and the second one is that everyone is capable of innovation. We should not say that only the design people and the production people, at a managerial or general manager level are capable of, getting new ideas. The level of innovation may differ, based on education, based on experience, or based on intelligence of a person, but innovation exists at every level. And every level's innovation is valuable. So whether it's a worker on the shop floor or an executive in an accounts department or a general manager. So, I've seen this in my own company when we acquired Anker Electricals in 2007. 2008 is when I came in, and we were just taking reins from the family. The Japanese management had come, four directors from Japan had come in. I joined in. And, we saw these workers on the shop floor who were day in and day out sitting on wooden stool and long tables and, assembling the switches and sockets. And it was amazing to see that the country's largest switch manufacturer working in a way they were. Over the years, of course, we brought in the ergonomic, sitting areas. We got in the cell production method. But the objective we gave to the workers was that we have to improve productivity every year. And we involved the workers in that. What the Japanese common word Kaizen is, very, very well-known word. But Kaizen basically means small improvements. And I can tell you very proudly that these small improvements have led to a worker productivity of nearly 300% increase since the time we have acquired. And it's amazing. All these ideas have come from the workers. So the typical things every morning, you get them together, congregate, tell them what are the objectives for the day, let them speak out if they have any suggestions in mind. So all this openness that we created in the HR, it's all helped so much that we are getting wonderful ideas from the workers today. And today the workers are participating in our competitions, internal competitions within Panasonic Group companies on the quality circles. And in fact, last year they won a silver award at Japan. So the, you know, the first time when the workers actually got in a quality circle team and won a competition in Japan. So I think this is really all about innovation. So it could be a small innovation, big innovation, but it could lead to substantial results. But the objective should be very clear. You know, you have to give them, you know, like, okay, reduce the cost by 10%, increase the market share by 3%, improve the productivity by 10%. You know, they have to be clearly definable and measurable objectives. But I think an open atmosphere, a recognition, a pat on the back, all these encourage innovation.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. After speaking to a lot of corporate leaders, and not just corporate leaders, but also SMEs amidst this pandemic situation, I actually understood that the companies and the entire dynamics have divided into two different set of organizations, not on monetary basis or revenue basis, but purely on the basis of the way they are delivering real value and the way they are connecting with the target audience. And by target audience, I don't just mean your buyer. I also mean your employee, because your employee is also your target audience, isn't it? And one thing which I have realized is that majority of the organizations which have failed, even the bigger organizations which have failed, and those who couldn't manage to survive this pandemic, were actually not delivering any real value, or were not able to connect to the target audience. This was one of the reasons why they failed. This is my anticipation, and this is the outcome of my discussions with a lot of corporate leaders. What do you have to say about
it? So you're right. I think, any company has various stakeholders, right? So it could be your suppliers, it could be your logistic partners, your own employees, your investors, your customers, of course. So I believe that for any healthy organization which wants to remain growing and wants to remain profitable, it's very important that there's a healthy relationship with all the stakeholders. And one has to look at the expectations of each stakeholder. You cannot ignore any stakeholder. So while customer is the king and customer is important, it doesn't mean that because of the customer, you kill the supplier, right? So I can again proudly say that right from day one, post Panasonic acquisition, the kind of ethos that we have created in the company is that of compassion. And the line which I keep telling to all managers is that we are a multinational company but with an Indian heart. Mm-hmm. And because when we acquired in 2007, some of the vendors and most of the customers had been with the company already for nearly 25, 30 years, whether our dealers, our metal suppliers in Jamnagar, they have been working for the company Anchor Electrical for 25, 30 years. You can't suddenly come and say, okay, I am a Japanese MNC, so from tomorrow onwards, everything has to be done in a strict manner. I will not accept this documentation. I will cut your payment, if there's a delay in supply by 5 days, etc., etc. Disciplining is important, but it's got to be done over a period of time. You have to give them time. They cannot overnight change and come up to your expectation. I think that has been one of our biggest success, in terms of being patient in the transformation that we brought in. Understanding the stakeholder need and creating it like a mutual relationship, I think, is one of the most important, because then these people support you in your worst times. Today, I don't know if you're tracking, but in the last 6 to 8 months, the metal prices, especially the copper prices, are absolutely going through the roof. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely uncontrolled. Similarly, in the plastics. So we buy a lot of polycarbonate and PVC and polybutyl. Mm-hmm. They are absolutely going through the roof. And more than that, there's a shortage for the last 3 months, partly because of shipping lines disruption from China, etc. Mm-hmm. I can proudly again tell you, our units have not closed down for a single day in the past 3 months. I know of many companies who had to shut down for a few days because of lack of raw material. And this continuous supply of material has only happened because of the trust we have built up with our suppliers. In fact, I think in the industry, Panasonic Life Solutions is known one of the best in terms of payment. So if our payment terms with the supplier is 45 days, he will get his payment on the 45th day or maybe on the 44th day, never on the 46th day. So that's the kind of reputation we have built up and the compassion. So I think these are the factors which ensure a constant success. That's what my.
And since we are already getting into the new normal, working from home and now slowly and gradually starting up our own offices, how do you see startup emerging in this particular space? Because, startup usually work with a lot of crunched financial situation. And since, they cannot afford to increase their working capital or even to invest money in procuring more space or hiring more people, how do you see startup taking over this entire pandemic situation and maybe creating more unicorns in India?
So I think for the startups, the COVID period was just a kind of a pause in between. So the startup industry in India will continue to grow for next, 10, 20, 30 years. It has to, because India has an immense pool of talent, so much of intelligence and education here. And this has to come out in the form of innovative products and services. So this will not be stopped. That is number one. Number two is India as a country has already established itself in confidence amongst the investors from abroad. They know that this country can fight anything. I mean, it can have its political issues, it can have its natural calamities, floods, rain and earthquake, etc. But this is a country of resilience. This is a country which can survive. More importantly, this is a country where judicial system works. It might take a longer time, but it works. I mean, some of the recent rulings on Vodafone, etc., would have built up the sentiment much, much more, right? Where you can actually win against the government as well. I don't know of any other country, including USA, which can offer this kind of a comfort to an investor. So money will not be a problem. So what do the startups need? They need an idea. So there's enough of ideation which will happen because there's so much of young crowd here, young people here passing out every year. They will create, keep looking at the problems which are, how do innovation happen? It happens from the problems around us. So all the problems that we have around us, they will keep identifying and creating products and services. There will be money available to back it up, and there will be a legal framework available to save the investors. So innovation from with the private equity funding, or any other form of funding will continue. Second form of innovation, which will really happen or is already happening now, is the industry-backed innovation. So we still have not evolved into an area where there is a strong industry, academia, a relationship, which typically happens in countries like Germany, UK, USA, even Japan. That is yet to happen. So, and that is beginning to happen. So imagine if Panasonic works along with IIT Bombay and IIT Bombay has got an incubator cell. So if you all work together, on some of the projects initiated by Panasonic. So we believe there are certain requirements, certain product requirement. Let's say air quality is a huge issue. So can we work on air quality with IIT Bombay? So those sponsored projects will come in a big way. So innovation post COVID will take off. It will take off exponentially. That's what my belief is.
Since you have already pointed out one key area which is of high concern for me, which is our entire policy is investor friendly, not the startup founder friendly. I've actually seen startup founders going down to as low as 2%, 3% equity stake because our policy believe that the investor who is pumping in money should hold the major stake, not the startup founders. don't you see this as a threat rather than as an opportunity? Because this entire policy is actually backing investors. That is the reason investors are more keen in coming, you know, down to India instead of going to any other developed country. Because if you see the situation in USA, you know, you will always find that the startup founders own the major equity and they still hold, you know, hold a say in the organization.
No, so Himanshu, I have a bit of a difference of opinion here. It's I think it's largely depending on what the starter founders' intentions are. So, of course, you know, there are other reasons which, you know, which I'll talk about. But today, if the founder is convinced about his idea being long-term and an idea which can keep evolving and sustaining over years and years together, he can always do a stepwise approach. See, there is no debate about the fact that if you have to grow a company, you need more money. So if I don't have money, I bring in equity investors. If I bring in equity investors, I have to dilute my equity. Right? It's a very simple formula. Now, the question is that once, let's say I have diluted 20-30% of the equity, can I come with another innovation in the same business for which I can renegotiate with the investors, and while retaining my equity, I can get them to invest more money? Because for the same set of product or service, if you're not innovating, you'll have to just keep diluting your equity in order to get more money. So of course there is a possibility that this whole thing can be supported by the government indirectly, wherein they provide, like they are providing let's say working capitals to a normal company, they can provide a subsidized working capital to innovators so that they can retain their majority stake or a major part of the stake and still fund the companies. So I think this is where it. I mean, I know of startups in India where the investors have still. I'm sorry, the innovate founders have still kept a majority stake with, you know, despite having a private equity player in playing in the company. The whole reason being that let's say with a 30% dilution, they managed to get whatever amount they wanted, and based on that, they scaled the operation so much that the turnovers went up. And the working capital and the cash was being managed very well, so they never ran short of cash, and they kept running the operations without diluting further.
But Dinesh, there is another side to it. You know, what I have seen in India, and this is from my personal experience. So let's say you are an investor and you are ready to invest X amount at 20% stake. However, if my valuation doesn't support that, then I might need to shell out 40% stake for the same amount of money that I need for my organization.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
This is where the bug lies.
But that is how the business has to be run, right? I mean, if I'm not able to justify my valuation, how is the valuation done normally, right? It's either done on the basis of an IP which you've created, but largely it is based on mm-hmm. the expected revenues and profits you're going to make based on the idea that you have got or the product that you have got, right? Mm-hmm. So if my idea or product has a potential of earning X revenues in the next 5 years, if I can make it make the X into 2X by bringing in some other thought, then I'm justified in that 20% liquidation. If not, then I have to be content with 40%.
But then in India, who justifies this X amount of revenue? Startup founder can justify the X amount of revenue. However, the concern in India, especially in a country like India, is that you need to have a certified valuator who can give valuation to your company, especially when you are a startup. And if the valuator doesn't agree on that, then he has the right to cut down your valuation.
No, fair point. So if you're saying valuator, then you're talking of.
So this is one of the reasons why I said that the entire ballgame in India is investor friendly, not the startup friendly. And if you see the case with every single startup that has become the unicorn, be it Paytm, be it Make My Trip, if you see the stakeholder of the main founders, you will find that majority of these stakeholders are sitting below 9% of equity.
So, Without sounding, let's say, sarcastic, and I'm not for one moment, I'm not bringing them down. Which of these is an original idea? None of them is an original idea.
None. I agree.
So as a founder, so Mr. Deep Kalra thought that making a portal for travel is a great idea because he's already seen Expedia do it in US and other countries. So he brings in a thought here, and he creates a portal. Gets a head start, makes valuation. And then when he wants to expand, he gets investors, he dilutes his valuation. Now, unless he comes up with another idea, let's say along with Make My Trip, he had started something, which was similar to, let's say, what is that? Forgetting the
Airbnb?
Name now. The one, Airbnb. Now, suppose he had got an Airbnb-like functionality built in. His valuation again would have gone up.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't he do that? I mean, that's what I'm saying. You see, if you're content with what you have already done, mm-hmm. Then you should also be ready for dilution in case you have to survive. But otherwise, you'll have to keep innovating. It's like a product life cycle. See, if I don't continue to innovate, my product cannot keep earning profits for me forever.
Absolutely, absolutely. Innovation is the key.
Correct, absolutely.
I completely agree on that. So, but at the same time, having the right investor is also a key. So majority of these startup founders in India, I was reading a survey, I believe you might have read it, that 90% of the startup fails in India within first 5 years.
But I thought that's the kind of statistics anywhere in the world.
Right. No. Since we are talking about India, let's focus on India. But then the reasons differs. There are countries, for example, if you talk about Europe, the government is ready to fund any startup which they find is promising. Wherein in India, we don't receive any fund until and unless the startup is actually generating revenue. Right? The dynamics differ. So I was going to ask you a different question pertaining to the same ecosystem, which is, how do you see startup founders, since the dynamics have changed, the investors have also changed. Now, since pandemic has given us the opportunity to innovate new things, but at the same time, it has also raised the question whether the new companies will be able to survive any threat like this particular pandemic or not. And investors are also being cautious in investing money in different organizations, which means there can be a challenge for young startup founders to raise capex, from investors. However, a well-established organization can easily raise capital if they need, because they have already proven it. How do you see this entire ball game supporting young startup founders who are just getting out of college or university and they have a dream to establish their own organization?
So, Himanshu, as I mentioned earlier, I don't see COVID affecting anything. I mean, this was just a pause in between. So in terms of backing up new ideas of innovators fresh from college, in fact, I think there'll be more encouragement, more fund coming in. And as I also mentioned, there will be more industry, academia, relationships getting formalized. So I have absolutely zero doubt on the fact that the startup, whole milieu will increase. And see, look at this. Today, the various institutions are actually taking pride in forming incubator cells. I mean, the IIT Bombay was one of the leaders, and I've known people in the SINE, they call it. They have incubated so many successful startups from their campus. Now, if I'm IIT and IIT Bombay student and I have an idea, I can literally get free space in IIT to run my startup maybe for a period of 3 years or 5 years before certain level of revenues are built up, and then I can move out. Now, it's not just IITs. I know of BITS Pilani. I know of Vellore Institute of Technology. I know of SRM. All these institutions are providing facilities to these small students to start their ideas, incubate it there, take it to a certain level of revenue and funding, and then move out of the campus. So these kind of incubator cells, I think the government will intervene. But when it comes to the funding of startups and creating guidelines on, as you mentioned, that there should be some agency doing the valuation, etc. I think then you're killing the free enterprise, spirit of free enterprise, because then you might become something like a China, you know, okay, theek hai, you bring your money in, but then you'll bring the money at our terms. So I agree to some regulation, intervention, support by the government, but not beyond a point. We need to have a free enterprise where startups survive on thorough fundamentals, on the strong base of their idea and the market. See, the greatest part about a startup in India is you have a domestic market to experiment anything. Right?
Absolutely.
I mean, the whole country is so big that if I want to, experiment in a small region, I can do that experiment. If that experiment is successful, I can take it global. That's the biggest advantage our country
Absolutely.
Offers. So the problem is, and I have seen many entrepreneurs, we become greedy very fast. I know of a company which we acquired, and which I would say, honestly, was screwed up. I'm sorry I'm using this language, but it was, completely spoiled by the private equity mm-hmm. investors, because this company was very strong in doing projects in south of India. Great name. And they could have expanded from south to west to east, etc. What did the private equity guys do? They started pushing them to go abroad, take projects in Middle East, take projects in Germany, take projects mm-hmm. in Australia. Why? Because they wanted their top line to go up. So their valuation goes up. In the process, they have killed the company. So this needs to be understood. This balancing is important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And simultaneously, since, majority of the, startup founders, they actually go for private equity in the initial stage, especially during seed and angel, because not many well-established VC firms or private equity firms are, pumping in money for seed or for angel these days. This could be one of the reasons why the private investors are backing up small companies and actually playing with the actual ethos of those companies to mint more money.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So this should not become a startup should not become, or any enterprise should not become a milking cow, I invest, I milk the cow, for 3, 4, 5 years.
Accidentally, I met a gentleman who call himself the angel investor, and he's a private investor, not the angel investing firm. And I asked him, what is his, way of investing money in startups, and what does he think before investing money? And the analogy that he gave me, I mean, it was insane. He actually said that I invest in 10 companies hoping that one of the company or two of the companies will succeed. So this is a pure play gamble. And if you are actually reaching out to investors like him, then there is no other way to eventually kill your company in the longer run.
But that is the thought which every private equity company has, that maybe 20% of their investment will yield returns, 80% will die.
Hmm.
And that's the reason that on the 20% companies which are successful, they are expecting abnormal yields, like a 30% per annum or a 40% per annum. And to drive those abnormal yields is what exactly is happening in the whole e-commerce space today.
Hmm.
None of the e-commerce companies, as you may know, is making profit. They're all growing their top lines, but none of them are making profit, right? Now, it's very easy for me to establish any e-commerce marketplace by discounting my products. Today I start offering grocery at 30% cheaper price than the market. I'll get more customers, right? I can keep increasing my revenue. And the whole reason is that no one is looking at what cost have I bought that product? Have I made money on that? Have I made profit of that? It's not being run like a real business. In the real world, no one will do that. In the virtual world, everyone is, trying to make money by having false numbers on paper. I mean, I call this false numbers because this is just discounted selling.
Mm.
So again, the question we should keep asking is, how long will it survive? How long, will keep, companies getting funded on a false premise? So the whole, it's a very large game, because India is just one of the drop in the whole ocean. Mm. Today, a company like, Amazon, for example, I mean, I would not ideally like to name anyone, but let's take an example of Amazon. It can continue to make losses in India for the next 5 years, as long as its valuation keeps going high, it keeps acquiring more share of the market, more customer clicks and so on and so forth. So the ball game is completely different.
Absolutely. And what, according to you, startup founders or even the existing organization should do to create a high performance organization?
Yeah. So I think whether it's a startup or, or an existing organization like ours, which is, nearly 55 years old, I think one thing which is very important is that every employee should feel wanted. You know, I think, any company, and I believe, any company, and except, okay, maybe a startup which has just started maybe a few years ago, but any company which has been in the business for, let's say, more than 10 years, will have two kind of people. There are what I would call as doers, and there are the other ones who are thinkers, right? So both are important. So today you can't have a organization where you just keep backing the thinkers, because they're the intelligent guys who have come from IIT and IIMs, and they are the ones who can only grow the company. The people who are doers have been doing that work for many years. They're able to do that work efficiently, productively, and without making mistakes, right? So first, I think premise has to be that every employee is important, and every employee, even the one who's doing a standard job, can be a high performer, right? Only thing is the scale might, the benchmark or the scale might differ, from a doer and a thinker. How does high performance come about? It basically comes about by unleashing a hidden potential. So every human being, according to me, can be made to perform better, right? So what is needed is to help him or her unleash their hidden potential, unleash their capability, and motivation. Motivation is the biggest driver for performance. So how do you get motivation? One is, of course, as I mentioned in the beginning, sense of purpose, I think, is one of the biggest important thing for having a motivated set of people in the organization. So sense of purpose for sure. And then, of course, recognizing the performance, incentives, elevation, recognition, a positive family life. I think that's very important. I think all of us have seen, if you don't have a healthy family life, it affects work, undoubtedly. So you have to make sure, whatever you call it, work-life balance, et cetera, the family life has to be. And the work culture in the organization. The organization, the work culture has to be open, that of trust, and not which is political and bitchy, etc. So all this leads to higher performance. The second one is, of course, about skill. Multi-skilling, I think, is very important. And again, I'll take an example from my company, where and I'll start with the workers, because when we took over, obviously every worker was doing one kind of a job. He or she had been doing the job for the last 10 years, 15 years. No one bothered to see that, are they capable of doing some more or something different. And so what we started doing was job rotation, which is a normal thing to do. We started rotating the workers from one product manufacturing to another product manufacturing in the same location. And we started improving their skills, and we started displaying those skills on the board. So we had the workers' photographs and the various, let's say there are five or six different skills, where there's a tick mark on which all skills that the worker has already acquired. And this was self-motivating for the workers, right? So that obviously has led to us having high-performing workers today, whose, as I mentioned, their productivity levels has gone up to 300%, unbelievable. Similarly, in the white collar, in the executives, I think that job rotation is very important. Because it's normal that if a person is in the same place, same location, same job, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, he's never going to be as motivated over the years. And then, of course, to achieve those job rotation, he gets training, he gets skill impartment, etc. What we did for the white collars was that, we were doing everything afresh, there was no, HR in place. I mean, when I say HR in place, a structured HR in place when it was a family-owned company, we started defining the skill requirement, functional skill requirement, and the behavioral skill requirement of every job position. Based on that, we drew up the skill matrix. And we started rating each person on that skill matrix. So, you create what is called as a radar diagram. And once you have that radar diagram, you know which are the areas of improvement. And then HR has started intervening on group basis or an individual basis to help the individual improve that specific skills where he or she is weak in.
Mm-hmm.
And that is helping us now create highly skilled executives, supervisors, managers, and then of course, the higher the skill, the more motivated they are, the better performance they do. So I think these are some of the ways in which performance increases and becomes a high performance organization.
No, and with this, it's time to say goodbye to you, Dinesh. It was a pleasure having you on the show. And I'm sure the listeners and the startup founders will be listening to this particular conversation, even the established businesses. They will get to learn a lot about how they can structure their company right amidst this pandemic situation and how they can take it forward with high performance capability.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that some of them will have a difference of opinion, but I will
always be there. We cannot control that.
So I'm open to answering or debating on that. So, but thank you very much, Himanshu, for having me. It was a real pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you for listening to The Edge Show. You can now listen to the same podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts, or you can watch it live on YouTube. And I'll see you in the next episode. Till then, stay safe and stay happy.